Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the December 16th, Thursday, reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today, we will be reading the following main articles. Gusts exceed 100 miles per hour. Winds cause power outages, hamper travel. By Kiernan Nicholson. Congress. Senate sends $768 billion defense bill to President. By Katie Edmondson. Inflation. Fed eyes three rate increases in 2022. By Jenna Smialek. Energy goals. Largest buildings to face deadline. Denver pushing to use a third less energy by 2030. By Conrad Swanson, and following up with miscellaneous articles. Gusts exceed 100 miles per hour. Winds cause power outages, hamper travel. By Kiernan Nicholson, The Denver Post. Extremely strong and destructive winds roared through Colorado Wednesday. Toppled trees and downed power lines brought widespread power outages, and travel was hampered by dust storms and trucks being blown over on roadways. In the metro area, the wind speed hit 95 miles per hour in the foothills of Jefferson County at White Ranch Park, and a 91 mile per hour blast was reported in southwest Boulder County, said Aisha Wilkinson, a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Boulder. The Weather Service reported a gust of 107 miles per hour in Lamar on Wednesday morning, and at the Air Force Academy airfield near Colorado Springs, 100 mile per hour gusts were recorded just before noon. The foothills generally had the highest wind gusts, Wilkinson said. The plains, although not as gusty, experienced a lot of dust storms and low visibility, and the mountains had a lot of blowing snow. Wilkinson described Wednesday's widespread weather as a Bora wind event, westerly winds racing down leeward mountain slopes and wreaking havoc. It's not uncommon in the winter, Wilkinson said, of the all-day storm. This one was very widespread, however, and everyone got an experience of gusty winds across the area. Dozens of commercial motor vehicles, mostly semi-trucks and trailers, were blown over by strong winds, said Master Trooper Gary Cutler, a State Patrol spokesman. A few truck drivers were taken to hospitals with injuries, but there were no reported fatalities related to wind-driven crashes. Roads and highways were shut down periodically Wednesday, including Interstate 70 eastbound from Burlington to Kansas and US 85 from Weld County Road 104 to Wyoming. On Wednesday morning, I-70 was closed briefly in both directions from Vail to Silverthorne because of winds and blowing snow. Power outages. About 3:40 p.m., about 59,000 customers around the Denver area were without power because of the wind, according to Xcel Energy. The statewide number for Xcel customers at that time was 62,512. Xcel Energy crews are working as quickly as possible to safely restore power to customers experiencing an outage during the severe wind event, the utility said in a statement. Xcel Energy has increased staffing levels and put operational plans in place to make sure key employees, including line workers, are available and able to respond to outages. Colorado Springs Utilities reported 20,000 customers affected by electric outages at about 1 p.m., and Black Hills Energy reported power outages in the Pueblo, Rocky Ford, and Canyon City areas because of severe winds throughout the region. transportation delays. At Denver International Airport, there were 584 delayed flights and 43 cancellations between 1 and 5 p.m. Wednesday, according to FlightAware. Departure delays averaged about 70 minutes, and inbound flights, because of the windstorm here, were delayed as much as 90 minutes. On Wednesday morning at DIA, at least 106 flights were canceled and 396 delayed. Throughout the day, DIA was limited to using two of its six runways because of the severe winds, said Stephanie Figueroa, an airport spokeswoman. Public mass transportation in the metro area also was affected by the storm. The University of Colorado A-Line train that runs from DIA ran an abbreviated 30-minute schedule on Wednesday. High winds led to 15-minute delays on W-Line, and the A-Line experienced 30-minute delays Wednesday. Notable damage and Thursday's forecasts. In Lakewood, Boulder, and other cities, traffic lights were out because of the winds, and local roads were closed by downed trees. In Arvada, the annual Old Town Christmas tree was toppled by the wicked winds. The high wind warning posted by the Weather Service expired at 5 p.m. On Thursday, winds will be much calmer, although it still may be a bit gusty in the foothills, Wilkinson said. The foothills will be a little gusty, but not as severe as today, Wednesday. Congress. Senate sends $768 billion defense bill to president, by Katie Amundson, the New York Times Company, Byline, Washington. The Senate on Wednesday passed a $768 billion defense bill, sending legislation to President Joe Biden that will increase the Pentagon's budget by about $24 billion more than he requested. The bill, which angered anti-war progressives who had hoped Democrats united control of Washington would lead to significant cuts in military spending, passed overwhelmingly on an 89-10 vote. It includes significant increases for initiatives intended to counter China and bolster Ukraine, as well as for more ships, jets, and fighter planes than the Pentagon requested. The lopsided votes in the Senate and the House, which passed the legislation last week, underscored the bipartisan commitment in Congress to spend huge amounts of federal money on defense initiatives at a time when Republicans have balked at spending even a fraction as much on social programs. Lawmakers said the measure was necessary, pointing to rising threats from China and Russia and previewing a looming race over military technology. Our nation faces an enormous range of security challenges, Senator Jack Reed, Democrat of Rhode Island, the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, said in a statement. To that end, this bill makes great progress, he added. It addresses a broad range of pressing issues, from strategic competition with China and Russia to disruptive technologies such as hypersonics, AI, and quantum computing, to modernizing our ships, aircraft, and vehicles. The bill contains a 2.7% pay increase for the troops and a painstakingly negotiated compromise to strip military commanders of authority over sexual assault cases and many other serious crimes. The new provision places such crimes under independent military prosecutors in a move that had long been opposed by military leaders and presidents. Biden and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin endorsed the change this year. The legislation's main focus, shifting attention from ground conflicts in the Middle East in favor of a renewed concentration on Beijing and Moscow, aligns with the foreign policy vision Biden outlined this summer as he ended America's 20-year war in Afghanistan. But even as Congress embraced that approach, members could not bring themselves to accept Biden's request to keep military spending essentially flat. And Democrats and Republicans instead linked arms in support of substantial increases. They sent an additional $2 billion to the Pacific Deterrence Initiative, a Pentagon program dedicated to bolstering the department's posture in the region, authorizing a total of $7 billion for it. Inflation. Fed eyes three rate increases in 2022. Officials also are being more aggressive in slashing bond buying, by Jenna Smialek, the New York Times company. Federal Reserve policymakers Wednesday said they will cut back on their stimulus more quickly at the moment of rapid inflation and strong economic growth, capping a challenging year with a pronounced policy pivot that could usher in higher interest rates in 2022. A policy statement and a fresh set of economic projections released by the central bank detailed a more rapid end to the monthly bond buying that the Fed has been using throughout the pandemic to keep money chugging through markets and to bolster growth. Officials are slashing their purchases by twice as much as they had announced last month, a pace that would put them on track to end the program altogether in March. That decision came in light of inflation developments and the further improvement in the labor market, according to the policy statement. Chairman Jerome Powell, speaking at a news conference after the Fed's meeting, said a strengthening labor market and in elevated inflation pressures prompted the central bank to speed up the reductions in asset purchases. Economic developments and changes in the outlook warrant this evolution, Powell said. He noted that supply chain disruptions have been larger and lasted longer than expected, and said price gains likely will continue well into next year. Ending the bond buying program sooner will position the central bank to more quickly raise its policy interest rate, the Fed's more traditional and more powerful tool, if officials decide that doing so is necessary to keep inflation under control. The Fed's economic projections suggested that officials expected to make three interest rate increases next year, setting up for a faster pace of rate increases as the economy recovers. Rates are currently set near zero, and officials project rates to stand at 2.1% at the end of 2024. With inflation having exceeded 2% for some time, the committee expects it will be appropriate to maintain this target range until labor market conditions have reached levels consistent with the committee's assessments of maximum employment, the Fed said in its new statement, putting the onus for rate increases squarely on labor market progress. Powell, in his remarks, suggested that the labor market was getting closer to meeting that test. In my view, we are making rapid progress toward maximum employment, Powell said. By slowing bond buying and moving decisively toward raising borrowing costs, the Fed is adding less juice to the economic expansion and completing a pivot toward inflation-fighting mode. While officials spent much of the year laying out a patient path for winding down their pandemic-era help for the economy, they have turned more proactive in recent weeks, as they have become more worried that a burst in prices this year could linger. Consumer prices climbed 6.8% in November from a year earlier, the quickest pace of increase since 1982. The Fed's preferred inflation gauge has shown slightly slower gains, but also has moved up sharply. Powell said that a quicker conclusion to bond buying will better position the Fed to react to a range of possible economic outcomes. The economy is so much stronger now, Powell said. Asked if there would be a big gap between when bond buying ended and when rate increases began, there wouldn't be the need for that kind of long delay. Fed officials initially expected a pop in prices this year to fade. Instead, pressures have broadened beyond goods affected by the pandemic, which have fallen victim to tangled supply chains, and into rent and shelter. In those big categories, upward trends can prove more lasting. Wages are climbing, as are consumer inflation expectations, which could help price increases to persist. The Fed has been watching the evidence accumulate warily, although most officials still hold out hope that inflation will fade back toward the 2% annual average goal as global shipping routes clear through backlogs, factory production increases to meet demand, and consumers shift toward more normal spending patterns after scrambling to buy couches, cars, and stationary bikes during the pandemic. But officials had begun to back away from helping the economy so much, announcing the initial plan to slow their bond buying program following their November meeting. Powell signaled late last month and early in December that the central bank was increasingly focused on managing the risk that rapid price gains might linger, teeing up the central bank's shift. "I think the risk of higher inflation has increased," Powell said while testifying before Congress in late November. The transition became official Wednesday. "They are revving up inflation, revising down unemployment, and as a result, they're pushing up the path for interest rates," Neil Dutta, head of U.S. economics at Renaissance Macro, said in reaction to the news. It's a bit of a 180 on Powell's part. Fed officials have also taken heart in the speed of the labor market recovery. The jobless rate has fallen to 4.2%, down sharply from the double-digit heights it reached early in the pandemic. Officials now expect unemployment to fall to 3.5%, matching its very low level headed into the pandemic by the end of next year, their updated economic projections showed. Job gains have been solid in recent months, and the unemployment rate has declined substantially, the Fed said in its new policy statement. Energy goals. Largest buildings to face deadline. Denver pushing to use a third less energy by 2030, by Conrad Swanson, The Denver Post. Officials in Denver's sustainability office are still calculating by how much the city's largest buildings must curb energy use in 2024 and 2027 on their way to meeting the end goal of using nearly one-third less energy by 2030. Smaller buildings also face required lighting or solar upgrades under the initiative, dubbed Energize Denver. And eventually, all commercial and multifamily buildings will be required to use electric heating and cooling systems. Homes are not required to cut energy use or install any new equipment under the new law, which the City Council unanimously approved last month. Katrina Manigan, with the Denver Office of Climate Action, Sustainability, and Resiliency, told the Denver Post that city officials will finalize those interim targets for 2024 and 2027 and inform building owners of the requirements by March. On Wednesday, she outlined those and other details from the initiative during a briefing for building owners and managers. All told, Denver's approximately 17,000 commercial and multifamily buildings pump out nearly 50% of the city's greenhouse gas emissions, Manigan said. And Energize Denver should reduce carbon dioxide emissions by 11.8 million metric tons of carbon dioxide by 2040. Plus, despite any upfront costs, Manigan said the improvements make financial sense as well. "This should lower the cost of doing business in Denver. This should lower the cost of operating these buildings in Denver," Manigan said. Manigan and other city officials behind the process have enjoyed strong support from a wide swath of property owners, businesses, trade associations, and environmental activists. Although some business and property owners, such as Steve Wheel, president of the Rock Mount Ranchware Manufacturing Company, take issue not only with the impending requirements, but also their timing. "This adds to the stress of trying to operate an efficient business during a pandemic," Wheel said. "Who needs this unnecessary brain damage?" Still, Manigan said the requirements are broad enough for building owners and managers to meet them in ways that best suit their needs and budgets. "Even if some can't make the grade, city officials can flex deadlines and other mandates to make it easier on them." "We know where the finish line is, and we know where we are today," said City Councilman Jolan Clark, who supported and helped craft the measure. "We built in as much flexibility as possible while still honoring the fact that we all have to get over the finish line." Denver's largest buildings. Buildings larger than 25,000 square feet, of which there are about 3,000, must cut the amount of energy they use per square foot by an average of 30% by 2030, compared with a 2019 baseline, Nanigan said. Those larger buildings will be split into different categories, such as hotels, offices, and multifamily buildings. Each type will have a different per square foot target, and ultimately, the cuts should average out to the 30% goal, Manigan said. Buildings housing multiple business types will be divided among those categories. Wheel said he already has invested a lot of money in making his buildings more efficient and took issue with city officials forcing owners to go even further. One size does not fit all, Wheel said. Why is my 30,000 square foot building in the same category as a 100,000 square foot building or bigger? But Manigan said those already operating above efficiency standards, about 15% of the largest buildings, won't have to make any more improvements. In addition, there isn't a specific way building owners must use less energy. They get to pick, Manigan said. Do they want to do a lighting upgrade? Do they want to turn off heating when it's not needed? Turn off the cooling when it's not needed? Lighting or solar? But Denver's smaller commercial and multifamily buildings between 5,000 and 25,000 square feet have less flexibility in the coming years. Energize Denver requires them to install LED lights, install an efficient lighting equivalent, or install or purchase enough solar power to offset one-fifth of the building's annual energy usage. Buildings between 15,001 and 24,999 square feet must finish the upgrades by December 31, 2025. The next category, buildings between 10,001 and 15,000 square feet, must finish by the end of 2026, and the smallest group of buildings must finish by the end of 2027. Manigan said about 6,000 buildings will have to make those upgrades. Heating and cooling. The last portion of Energize Denver will require all commercial and multifamily buildings to replace their heating and cooling systems gradually with electric ones, Clark said. City officials will update Denver's building code to wean buildings off older gas heating and cooling systems, Manigan said. The ordinance gives the City Council deadlines at the start of 2023, 2025, and 2027 to update the Denver Building and Fire Code with different components of those requirements. The idea is to encourage building owners and managers to replace gas heating and cooling systems at the end of their useful life and when that is the most financially viable option, Clark said. This isn't saying let's go and fill the landfill with perfectly good operating systems, Clark said. Still, Wheel said he just installed a new heating system in his building, replacing one that lasted 80 years or more. He said engineers have told him they're not sure his building could be adapted to an electric system at all. Plus, Wheel expressed concern that Denver's grid won't be able to handle a larger demand for electricity with all these upgrades. But Manigan said the grid was built to handle massive demand during the summer and should be able to take on the increase, perhaps with a few localized infrastructure improvements needed. Clark acknowledged that concerns do exist, but said cutting emissions will only become more difficult with each passing day. He and others on the Energize Denver Task Force work to include as much flexibility as possible into the law, especially to keep upgrade costs low. He also noted the diverse representation on the task force, which includes officials from Xcel Energy, the Colorado Oil and Gas Association, the Sierra Club, the Colorado Hotel and Lodging Association, and more. In addition, Clark said much more is needed to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but this is a start. This is one piece, he said. It's a big piece, but it's still just one piece. Minimum sentences. Trucker's 110-year prison term in fatal I-70 crash spotlights laws. By Shelley Bradbury, The Denver Post. The 110-year prison sentence meted out this week to the truck driver who killed four people when he lost his brakes on Interstate 70 put a renewed spotlight on Colorado's mandatory minimum sentencing laws and on district attorneys' ability to use such laws to ensure convictions lead to prison time. Rogel Aguilera Medeiros, 26, was sentenced to a prison term twice as long as some Colorado murderers after his convictions triggered provisions in state law that forced District Judge Bruce Jones to lay down a minimum 110-year sentence. The judge said during Monday's sentencing hearing that he had no discretion to set a lesser prison term, although he would have liked to. One family member of a man who died in the fiery 28-car pileup in Lakewood said he did not want a life sentence for the truck driver. And the day after the sentencing, First Judicial District Attorney Alexis King, who pursued the convictions that led to the 110-year sentence, said in a statement she would welcome a reconsideration of the prison term. Aguilera Medeiros' sentence stretched to more than a century because, under Colorado law, first-degree assault and attempted first-degree assault are so-called crimes of violence in which prison sentences must run consecutively and not concurrently when they spring from the same incident. This is a grossly excessive sentence, said Mark Silverstein, legal director for the ACLU of Colorado. It cries out for the reform of sentencing laws, but I think calls for change also need to be directed at the seldom criticized but largely unchecked power of prosecutors. They have the power to decide who goes to prison and for how long. Prosecutors decide on the charges to file, and they decide what plea bargains to offer. King refused to talk to the Denver Post about the case, which initially was charged under her predecessor, Pete Weir, and instead sent statements through a spokesman this week. The facts and consequences of Mr. Aguilera Medeiros' decisions that day were extraordinary enough to support pursuing first-degree assault charges, she said. Aguilera Medeiros refused to accept any plea offer other than a traffic ticket, King said, and the convictions recognized the harm caused to victims of the crash. My administration contemplated a significantly different outcome in this case, but Mr. Aguilera Medeiros wasn't interested in pursuing those negotiations, she said. Aguilera Medeiros' attorney, James Colgan, would not discuss what sort of plea bargain was considered, except to say that the discussions were not fruitful. Silverstein said King's statement suggests the district attorney's office overcharged the case to try to pressure Aguilera Medeiros into pleading guilty rather than taking the case to trial. It's out of line for the prosecutor to blame the defendant for exercising his constitutional rights, Silverstein said. George Brochler, former district attorney for the 18th Judicial District, disagreed. I have little sympathy for someone who turns down a reasonable plea bargain offer and then goes to trial and bemoans the fact that the worst thing that could happen to them happened, he said. Mandatory consecutive sentences. Colorado's mandatory minimums largely were established in the 1990s as a tough-on-crime response to rising crime rates and a perception among conservative politicians that the state's judges were handing out light sentences, said Stan Garnett, former Boulder County District Attorney. There were concerns that sentences for the same crimes varied dramatically, depending on the judge and perhaps on the defendant, Brockler said. The laws give tremendous power to district attorneys, Garnett said. You can, in the way you charge the case, predetermine what the sentence is going to be and put an extreme amount of pressure on the defendant to plead, he said. It makes it impossible for a judge to fashion a sentence that fits the particular crime and particular defendant. Brockler said that the laws ensured that perpetrators of violent crime who harm multiple victims are held responsible with prison sentences for each victim because the terms must run consecutively. This guy killed four people, Brockler said. How much time are four lives worth? He added that people convicted of vehicular homicide in Colorado, which carries a recommended sentence of 2 to 6 years in prison, are eligible to be sentenced to probation instead of prison. If that was the only charge, vehicular homicide, that guy might have walked out of the courtroom, he said. There's no outcome using those weak charges that comes even close to justice. that can't be justice when you kill four people. A jury in October found Aguilera Medeiros guilty of four counts of vehicular homicide, six counts of first-degree assault, 10 counts of attempted first-degree assault, four counts of careless driving causing death, two counts of vehicular assault, and one count of reckless driving. A chance to reduce the sentence. The state's mandatory minimum laws have faced criticism in recent years, and some of the state's minimums have been reduced or removed. State Senator Bob Gardner, a Colorado Springs Republican who sits on the state's year-old sentencing reform task force, said Tuesday that he's looking into Aguilera Medeiros' case. When I saw the story this morning, I thought it was worth making some inquiries of both prosecutors and defense counsel alike as to whether this is an anomaly, whether this is something we ought to deal with, and frankly, to see whether it is something as we're doing our sentencing reform that could be addressed, he said. The task force, formed by Governor Jared Polis last year to review and suggest changes to the state's sentencing laws, began its work with misdemeanor cases and has not yet considered reforms to felony sentencing, said Maureen Kane, a task force member and director of legislative policy and external communications for the state's public defender's office. That work should start next year. Aguilera Medeiros intends to appeal the jury's verdict, Colgan said, and is considering a variety of challenges to the sentence, although those challenges will have to wait until the appeal process concludes. An online petition calling for Polis to commute Aguilera Medeiros' sentence had nearly 600,000 signatures Wednesday. The law is just so frustrating because it ends up in miscarriages of justice like this, Colgan said Tuesday. The law is poorly written. The state's mandatory sentencing law allows for the trial judge to reduce the sentence within 91 days of Aguilera Medeiros' commitment to the Department of Corrections after the department evaluates Aguilera Medeiros and submits a report to the judge. The judge must find unusual and extenuating circumstances to modify the sentence, the law says, a step Jones implied Monday he would be willing to take. Aguilera Medeiros could also ask the court to reconsider the sentence through other legal avenues, Colgan said. Colgan expects Aguilera Medeiros will not be eligible for parole until he is in his 70s or 80s. State law says he must serve 75% of a sentence, that would be about 82 years, before he can be paroled. That percentage often ends up being closer to 50% of the total sentence once the Department of Corrections applies credits for time served, good time, and other measures, Brockler said. Nobody on planet Earth can tell you how many days this guy will serve before he is parole eligible, Brockler said. Colgan said the state's mandatory minimum sentencing laws should be changed to give more discretion to judges. If you don't allow the judge to put some humanity into the law, it becomes a rubber stamp, he said, and everybody gets sucked in. Union Station restrooms closed. RTD studies options to reopen facilities to paying customers in effort to boost safety, by Joe Rubino, The Denver Post. The Regional Transportation District has shut down the public restrooms in the Union Station bus terminal at least through the end of the year, and the agency is looking into cordoning off a piece of the terminal so that it is accessible only to people who have paid fares, officials say. Meanwhile, Denver police made numerous arrests around the station last week, according to Chief Paul Pazin, as officials work to clamp down on an escalation in drug activity and other unwanted behavior at the city's troubled central transit hub. RTD General Manager and CEO Deborah Johnson updated the agency's board about efforts to address public safety at Union Station during a meeting December 7th. The bathrooms in the station's underground bus terminal were shut December 3rd, after testing found trace amounts of fentanyl on surfaces, Johnson said. While the levels of the narcotic were not dangerous, the agency is using the temporary shutdown to make repairs and install permanent doors on the restrooms. The public restrooms will remain closed through the end of the year until such time the doors can be installed and protocols and procedures can be put in place, such as a permanent restroom attendant in the form of a security guard, Johnson told the board last week. RTD officials also are exploring adding infrastructure to the terminal to create a separate area accessible only to customers who have paid fares. It's a process that includes looking into innovative funding sources, Johnson said. Infrastructure could mean turnstiles or gates, according to RTD spokeswoman Pauletta Tunelis. In an interview with the Denver Post this month, Johnson said the pandemic and issues that have spun off from it have turned Union Station into a place where people with non-destinations gather, leading paying customers to feel unwelcome and unsafe. Changes to the terminal space are moving forward as the Denver Police Department increases its enforcement efforts around the station campus. Johnson announced at the end of November that RTD was bringing in teams of Transportation Security Agency agents and members of the volunteer Guardian Angels to boost the number of eyes watching for illegal activity around the station, even if neither group has the power to enforce local laws. Mayor Michael Hancock vowed city officials would redouble our efforts to ensure Union Station is clean and safe for all in a statement December 3rd. That same day, Johnson met with Pazin to discuss how the police department could help RTD's transit police and contract security officers. Police officers have since made arrests around the Union Station campus, Pazin said last week, including for drug charges and outstanding warrants. He declined to discuss how many officers were assigned to the area, but said the department also has directed a social worker and its substance use navigation team members to spend time there. We have committed significant resources to address these issues, including narcotics enforcement, Pazin said. We're committed to working with our RTD partners to get these issues addressed appropriately, and we will stay engaged until these issues have been mitigated. The department's interactive crime map shows that from December 3rd to December 8th, 36 crime reports were filed for locations around the Union Station campus. Of those, 15 were drug and alcohol-related offenses. A report does not necessarily mean an arrest was made, police spokesman Doug Shupman said in an email. The restroom shutdown could have consequences for unhoused people, said Kathy Alderman, spokeswoman for the Colorado Coalition for the Homeless. Without available public facilities in the area, people experiencing homelessness may have to go to the bathroom in alleys and other outdoor areas, something that opens them up to criminal penalties that perpetrate challenges in finding work and getting into stable housing. I understand why they may need to do it for a period of time, but I hope this isn't a long-term closure, Alderman said. It's a public space, and we should be respectful of that. Alderman worries that people assume all the public safety issues at Union Station can be attributed to unhoused people, when there is a lot of criminal activity and drug use that comes from housed individuals that come from elsewhere. DPD has seen problems with rampant public drug activity, aggressive behavior, and other safety concerns crop up in other neighborhoods around Denver in recent years, Pazin said, mentioning Curtis Park, Capitol Hill, Golden Triangle, and the 16th Street Mall. Until there are additional consequences, accountability, and support for individuals engaging in these types of behavior, these enforcement efforts are likely to push this into a different neighborhood, Pazin said. Extension for Marrero on DPS agenda. The Denver Board of Education will vote Thursday evening on whether to extend Superintendent Alex Marrero's contract with Denver Public Schools until at least 2025, 2 years longer than the original terms of the agreement. Marrero, who previously served as interim superintendent of City School District of New Rochelle, New York, was chosen to lead Colorado's largest school district in May and took over in July. The school board will vote Thursday. If it passes, Marrero's contract will change from a 2-year term to a 4-year term, according to the news release. The current contract sets his term of employment through 2023. This was by Jessica Seaman, the Denver Post. Hickenlooper urges change to filibuster. Colorado Senator John Hickenlooper on Wednesday called for the Senate to limit use of the filibuster power as a way to block voting rights legislation. Hickenlooper, along with other Senate Democrats, has been pushing this past year to protect and expand voting rights, co-sponsoring 3 bills. He has advocated increased voting by mail, but Republican threats to filibuster this legislation led to failure. Protecting the right to vote shouldn't be a partisan issue, and we set out to work across the aisle, but 3 separate voting rights bills have failed in the Senate this year, Hickenlooper said in a statement Wednesday. Voter disenfranchisement threatens our entire democracy. If we can change the process on the debt ceiling, then surely we can do the same to protect our democracy. The bills that Senate Democrats tried to pass this year were the For the People Act, the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, and the Freedom to Vote Act. In recent days, Democratic leaders have indicated they want to prioritize voting rights action before the end of the year to maximize voting in the midterm elections. This was by Bruce Finley, the Denver Post. Colorado, cash aid went out to families Wednesday, by Alex Burness, the Denver Post. Some 600,000 Colorado households were slated Wednesday to receive their monthly payment through the federal expanded child tax credit program, but those families should not count on this program continuing. Unless Congress acts to extend the program, and that doesn't appear likely this calendar year, there's no promise of any payments beyond those sent December 15th. If this program expires, said U.S. Senator Michael Bennett, a Colorado Democrat who has championed this tax credit, it's going to make it harder for families to pay the rent, to pay for food, to pay for childcare. These aren't small things. A lot of that, all of that, will go away if we don't find a way to extend the credit, Bennett told the Denver Post on Wednesday. The expanded child tax credit was approved in the spring in the American Rescue Plan, a broad COVID-19 stimulus and relief measure signed into law by President Joe Biden. It made several changes to the existing child tax credit program. It increased the size of the credit, which previously awarded $2,000 to families for each child 16 and under, up to $3,600 for children under 6, and $3,000 for children 6 to 17. Its eligibility rules were relaxed to allow all families to benefit even if they don't earn enough money to owe taxes, and it gave families the option to get monthly payments instead of an annual lump sum tax refund. In Colorado, as around the country, the result of the expansion has been a dramatic reduction in child poverty. The families of some 1 million children here qualified for advanced CTC payments in November, the Treasury Department reported, with total payments in the state exceeding $261 million. The average participating household in Colorado got $434 last month. This and other forms of cash aid created an unlikely outcome in the pandemic. Poverty in Colorado and the country has fallen, state analysts say, despite a recession last year and elevated unemployment. State Senator Dominic Moreno, who led the Legislative Budget Committee during Colorado's economic rebound this year, told the Post in October, "It's not rocket science. If people have enough to live on, then the poverty measures shrink, and a host of other social issues are mitigated." But Moreno, a Commerce City Democrat, also said, "I don't really see a sustainable path for continuing that trend into the future unless there's that federal government support. Certainly in the state, we don't have the resources to do that." This is why the child tax credit's expiration date carries such significance. The Democrats who control both chambers of Commerce are advancing the president's Build Back Better agenda, a social spending and climate package that includes a 1-year extension of the expanded child tax credit. That plan would also include a permanent extension of the provision that allows families to benefit whether or not they earn enough to pay taxes. But it is on hold now, in large part because of opposition from the conservative Democrat Joe Manchin, a U.S. senator from West Virginia who is frequently at odds with his own party. Democrats can't afford to lose a single vote in the Senate, so Manchin's buy-in is critical. He's wary of the projection that this program will cost more than $500 billion over the next 5 years. Bennett retorts that it would be more costly not to extend the program. Child poverty costs this country $1 trillion a year, he said. I'd much rather reduce the amount of child poverty in this country than pay for the cost of mitigating it. Bennett said he is still trying to convince Manchin. He knows as well as I do that Congress has little trouble extending tax cuts for the wealthiest people in this country, he said. For once, maybe what we ought to do is extend a tax cut for working people and middle-class people. Denver. Man hit by bus dies, by Kiernan Nicholson, The Denver Post. A Denver school bus driver hit a pedestrian Wednesday morning, and the man later died at a hospital. The incident happened at East Evans Avenue and South Oneida Street, Denver police said in an 8:07 a.m. tweet. No children were on the bus at the time of the collision. The school bus was westbound on East Evans Avenue at the time of the collision, and the man, who was not identified, was crossing the avenue in the middle of the block, police said. An investigation is ongoing. Weld County. Officials detect elevated benzene in community, by Bruce Finley, The Denver Post. Colorado health officials are investigating elevated benzene detected last week by an air monitoring truck parked in a community 600 feet from an oil and gas industry site in Weld County. The state's mobile lab last week measured benzene in the air north of Union Reservoir at 9.9 parts per billion, above the federal health-based guideline level of 9 parts per billion. While this doesn't mean an immediate health risk to nearby residents, further investigation is necessary, Colorado Department of Public Health and the Environment officials said Wednesday, and they'll seek help from the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. We are committed to problem solving, working with local governments, and ensuring Colorado communities are clean, safe, and healthy, CDPHE's Director of Environmental Health and Protection, Sean McGrath, said in a statement Wednesday afternoon. The federal guideline levels are set below the levels where residents typically would experience health concerns. The truck measured the elevated benzene on December 11th near Cub Creek Energy's night operation, and analysts on December 13th confirmed the results. State officials said there are about 50 homes within about two-thirds of a mile of where the mobile lab measured the elevated benzene. This is the second time the lab has measured benzene in air above the health guideline level. The first was in 2019 near the Bea Romero School. CDPHE officials deployed the truck to gather information about emissions and measured for more than 400 hours. The truck detected the elevated benzene once. There's not enough information to determine the source of the elevated benzene, officials said. The investigators will now inspect the Cub Creek Energy site and look for other potential sources, take more measurements of benzene and other volatile organic chemicals in the area, and determine how frequently benzene is elevated. Long-term exposure to benzene in the air at high levels can cause cancer, federal health agencies have determined. Benzene comes from many sources, including industrial sites, vehicles, landscaping machinery, cigarette smoke, and household products. Colorado residents often are exposed at low levels, and health impacts, including headaches, skin and eye irritation, and breathing trouble, depend on how much is in the air, how long, and how often people inhale it. Pandemic. Kroger eliminates paid COVID-19 leave for unvaccinated workers, by Derek Bryson Taylor, The New York Times Company. Kroger, the national supermarket operator, parent company of King Soopers and City Market, and one of the nation's largest retailers, has restructured its COVID-19 benefits for unvaccinated employees and will charge some of them if they remain unprotected, a spokeswoman for the company confirmed Wednesday. Last year, before coronavirus vaccines were available, the company began offering 2 weeks of paid time off to employees who contracted COVID-19. Kroger told employees last week that beginning January 1st, that benefit would no longer be available to people who were unvaccinated, the spokeswoman said. The news was reported by the Wall Street Journal on Tuesday. Unvaccinated employees still will be eligible for other forms of leave, but the special time off now will be open only to fully vaccinated employees. Kroger also said it would charge salaried workers who are enrolled in a company health care plan $50 a month if they remain unvaccinated. That surcharge would not apply to unionized workers and hourly wage associates enrolled in a company health care plan. We created and amended several workplace policies at the onset of the pandemic to support our associates during immense uncertainty, the spokeswoman said in a statement. The administration of the vaccine to our associates has been an integral part of our efforts and continues to be a focus. It was unclear how many of Kroger's 500,000 employees have been vaccinated. This year, Kroger said it would give a one-time payment of $100 to all associates who received the COVID-19 vaccine, joining a wave of companies, cities, and states in offering similar incentives. Kroger said it would continue that program. In September, the Biden administration issued three vaccine mandates, one for federal contractors, another for healthcare workers, and a third for companies with more than 100 employees. All three of the mandates affecting the private sector have been put on hold by courts because of legal challenges. Employers and governors, mostly in Republican states, have opposed President Joe Biden's mandates that employees of large companies must be vaccinated or get tested weekly, arguing that it was overreach. When asked about Kroger's new policies, Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary, said during a news briefing Tuesday, "We know different private sector companies and entities are going to take different steps to incentivize people to get vaccinated, to keep their employees safe and their workforce safe." She stressed that the company's new policy did not come from the federal government. Kroger, which was founded in 1883 and is based in Cincinnati, operates more than 2,500 stores in 35 states and the District of Columbia under a number of name brands, according to its website. In news briefs from Denver Post Wire Services, Malta, first EU country to legalize marijuana. Malta on Tuesday became the first country in the European Union to agree to legalize the use and growing of marijuana for recreational purposes, the latest sign of a more liberal approach to the substance being taken in the bloc in recent years. The law, passed by Parliament and awaiting the president's signature, considered a formality, to come into effect, allows people to carry up to 7 grams of marijuana, grow up to 4 plants, and keep up to 50 grams of cannabis at home. Similar forms of decriminalization exist in other European countries, such as the Netherlands, Portugal, and Spain. But in those cases, possession of small amounts of cannabis can still be a civil offense, and coffee shops or cannabis social clubs are tolerated. Germany expels Russian diplomats over state-ordered killing. Byline, Berlin. Germany announced Wednesday it is expelling 2 Russian diplomats after a German court concluded that Moscow was behind the killing of a Chechen man in Berlin 2 years ago. Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock called the state-ordered killing a grave breach of German law and the sovereignty of the Federal Republic of Germany. Russia's ambassador in Berlin was summoned to discuss the court's finding as was informed of the diplomat's expulsion, she said. The 2019 brazen daylight killing of Zelimkan Torniki Kangoshevili, a 40-year-old Georgian citizen of Chechen ethnicity, sparked outrage in Berlin and prompted the German government to expel two other Russian diplomats at the time, a move Russia swiftly reciprocated. Congress sends Biden $2.5 trillion debt limit increase, byline Washington. Congress averted a catastrophic debt default early Wednesday after Democratic majorities in both chambers voted to send a $2.5 trillion increase in the nation's borrowing authority to President Joe Biden over lockstep Republican opposition. Capping a marathon day, the House gave final approval to the legislation early Wednesday on near party line 221-209 vote, diffusing a volatile issue until after the 2022 midterm elections. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler,